Welcome, dear readers. You're listening to Time to Read, a Winnipeg Public Library podcast book club. We're recording today from the Carol Shields Auditorium at Millennium Library in Winnipeg, which is within Treaty 1 territory, the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, and Dakota peoples, and in the national homeland of the Red River Métis. Our drinking water comes from Shoal Lake 40 First Nation in Treaty 3 territory. In this episode, we will be discussing Bel Canto by Anne Patchett. I'm Dennis from the Idea Mill, and I hope that when I die, someone will describe me as punctual. Across the table from me is...
I'm Toby. I'm an outreach librarian based out of here at Millennium Library. And did you hear about the opera singer who threw the game opening baseball?
Nope.
They say she had perfect pitch. And across the table from me is...
Hi, I'm Trevor. I work at the Louis Riel Library. And my main takeaway from this novel is that if you stay home to watch your favorite soap opera, that's probably the most sensible thing any character does in this movie.
A good book can carry me away from an average and ordinary day, yeah. So keep it down, leave me alone, close the doors and turn off the phone, 'cause all I ever really need is a little more time to read.
And you, dear readers, we wouldn't do this without you. We'd love to hear from you, especially if it's in song form. Send us a message before your favorite show starts. You can find our email address and all our social media outlets by going to wpl-podcast.winnipeg.ca and scrolling to the bottom of the page. Hang around till the end of the episode to enjoy our favorite segment, Nerd Words for Word Nerds. Before we dig in, let's do a quick check-in with our panel. How's it going?
I totally wasn't prepared for this part, even though I know we talked about it.
Do we need to say about how this book has checked off both mine and your reading resolutions?
Yeah, that's a great idea. So to my delight, regular listeners may think back to our New Year's episode, and one of my resolutions was I would try to read as many books that I just found in my house that I hadn't read. And lo and behold, in my basement was a kind of rough, beat up, slightly copy of Anne Patchett's Bel Canto. I'm holding it up so Dennis and Toby can see, like, it's something I don't realize that's our book. So yeah, score one for my reading resolution.
And my reading resolution was to reread more books, and Bel Canto is a reread for me. So there you go.
And unfortunately, it doesn't work for me because it's not a comedy.
Yeah.
It's not a comedy.
It's funny. It's funny.
It's got funny parts, yeah. But it's not a comedy.
No, it's not a comedy.
No, it's a little weird, but it's not a comedy.
Okay.
Something else we should mention, I always say at the beginning that you can find our social media outlets by going to our website at wpl-podcast.winnipeg.ca. We are in the process of transitioning to a new host for the podcast, so our website is going to look a little different. And ideally, you don't have any different way of getting to it. You'll just use the same address and get to it, but you may notice that it looks a little different. Don't let that throw you. Same people. Same show, just different host.
Yeah, we're hoping, and by different host, we don't mean like a different host.
Web host.
Exactly. Yes. And hopefully this message will just be irrelevant to everyone, that if you already subscribe, that the next episode will appear just as night follows day. But we want to go give you everyone a heads up because we're just making this little bumpy transition and we want it to be as smooth as possible.
Yeah. In an ideal world, you wouldn't know it happened if I hadn't mentioned it. Any other things?
No.
In that case, Toby is going to tell us about the author, after which Trevor will give us a summary of the book.
Okay, it's time to talk about my favorite Catholic, Anne Patchett, who, as you both know, I'm a big fan of hers. I've been a fan of hers for many years, and I know a lot about her because she's written many essay collections in which she writes about, like, her family and her relationships. And
I'm feeling this is going to be a half hour segment.
Well, that's the point, is that I really needed to condense the information to pull out what, you know, the important bits, not that she took a year off from shopping, but like where she went to school. But, you know, if you are interested in more information about Anne Patchett, it is out there. Is what I'm saying. Okay, so she was born December 2nd, 1963, in Los Angeles, California, to Frank Patchett, who is a police captain, and Jean Ray, who is a nurse turned novelist. Her parents divorced when she was young, and her mother remarried, moving the family to Nashville when Patchett was six. She attended a private Catholic school and has often spoken of how a childhood spent praying to statues and dreaming of miracles was the perfect preparation for her life as a storyteller. She obtained a BA in creative writing at Sarah Lawrence College and then an MFA at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. She spent many years writing for magazines while writing fiction on the side. In her late 20s, she won a fellowship to the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, Massachusetts. During her time there, she wrote her first novel, The Patron Saint of Liars, which was published in 1992. She wrote many other novels, but then it wasn't until her fourth novel, Bel Canto, that was published in 2001, that was her breakthrough novel. It was a National Book Critics Circle Award finalist and won the Orange Prize and the Penn Faulkner Award. She's written many books since then, including State of Wonder, which was shortlisted for the Orange Prize, The Dutch House, which was nominated for the Pulitzer, and most recently, Tom Lake. She's also written two children's books and many nonfiction books, including Truth and Beauty, about her friendship with author Lucy Greeley, and more recently, the essay collection These Precious Days. In that essay collection, there's an essay called There Are No Children Here, where she discusses her certainty about not wanting children, and which is a topic she's been very open about. In that collection, she also writes about owning a bookstore and how that's enriched her life. In 2011, she opened Parnassus Books in Nashville. She writes, "I once believed that nothing could surpass winning a big literary award, but I was mistaken. The thing that's been so much better has been to create jobs in my community. Even the introverted readers, the silent writers, want a place where they feel welcomed and understood. That's how I discovered that my truest destiny was a thing I never saw coming." She's become a real champion for independent bookstores and is also an ambassador for the Book Industry Charitable Foundation. She hosts authors at her store who usually also stay with her in her home. She says, "I want to be part of the ecosystem that keeps our industry alive." Her work has been criticized for being too cheery. Of this, she says, "I have been accused of being a Pollyanna, but I think there are plenty of people dealing with the darker side of human nature. And if I'm going to write about people who are kind and generous and loving and thoughtful, so what? In my life, I have met astonishingly good people." She lives in Nashville with her husband, Carl Van Devender, and their dog, Sparky, who is often on their on Parnassus Books social media. There you go.
Well, I'm about to read a summary of the very cheery Bel Canto, which... all right, here we are. Set in an unnamed Latin American country, the story begins at a fancy soiree thrown at the country's vice presidential home. The ostensible reason for this party is to celebrate the birthday of Katsumi Hasakawa, the chairman of a large Japanese company and opera enthusiast. The underlying reason for the party is to court Hasakawa's company into investing in the country by building factories there. Hasakawa is secretly only at this party and visiting this country because the government enticed American soprano Roxanne Cost to perform as the evening's entertainment. Near the end of the party, members of a terrorist organization break into the house, intending to take the president of the country hostage. When they realize the president is not in attendance, the terrorist group decides to take the entire party hostage. And after determining they have too many hostages, the terrorists decide to release all of them except for those they deem most likely to return a large ransom. The standoff drags on, longer than anyone could have expected. Hours turn into days, days into weeks, and weeks into months. We get to know several characters quite well throughout this ordeal, both hostage and terrorist. We see the lines between them blur and then almost disappear. We find common ground between unlikely people and shared beauty through the power of music. Two major romantic relationships develop as the standoff drags on, and they serve as the backdrop to the rest of the story. The first romantic relationship is between Cost and Hasakawa, who develop a deep bond even though they do not speak each other's language and thus cannot communicate verbally. The second relationship is between the translator Gen and the young terrorist Carmen, who must keep their love a secret. The two lovers meet in the china closet every night on the premise of Gen teaching Carmen Spanish. In reality, they were teaching each other the language of love. Thanks, everyone. And then, but, you know, this can't go on forever. How does the story end? Well, how could it ever end any other way? For the briefest of moments, some of the characters imagine wildly happy endings, escaping together in the night, living forever in this mansion, in this arrangement, everyone being freed, terrorists and hostage hand in hand. But reality crashes into this dreamlike world in a kind of an operatic over-the-top ending, which we can talk about. Bel Canto. That was probably the most abrupt ending to a summary I've done. But
well, that That's okay.
All right.
It was it an happens. Abrupt ending to a book.
It was.
Yeah.
So I usually say, how did you find this one? We know that.
Yeah, I want to let you two talk first because I'm very, very curious.
Okay. As mentioned in the check-in, I literally found this book in my basement.
Yeah.
But that's not what you meant. That's just more a joke from Susie Maloney from last month. I mean, I had read only one other Ann Patchett book up to this point, which was Dutch House, which I loved. Loved. I just thought she was an incredible writer. And so, obviously, at one point, I thought I would read Bel Canto because I purchased it, or it somehow came into my house. I don't know. Who knows how things come to you? Mm-hmm. What are our thoughts? What are my thoughts on this book? Well, I had an interesting experience reading it because I read the first 9 chapters in my own copy, and then the e-audiobook came in for me. So I listened to the final chapter and the epilogue as an audiobook, and I discovered some of the pronunciation of the characters were different than what I had thought. So a character, the translator, whose name is spelled G-E-N, is pronounced Gen, not Jen. And there's what I would have called General Benjamin is pronounced Ben-Hamin, which that makes sense, I guess, because it's a Spanish setting. So what did I think of this book? Well, I mean, obviously, extremely well written, very engaging. It was sort of like, you know, a what if, you know, like people that would not normally be in a room together into a room together and see what happens. There are a couple of points that really stood out to me. One was that both of these groups of people, the hostages and the terrorists, are doing something that they never have time for, which is just spending time listening to music. The hostages are often diplomats or business people who fill their schedules with meetings and work and making money, and they don't have time for the simple, joyful things that bring us happiness in life. And the terrorists, a lot of them are like kids, you know, living in the jungle. They're just, you know, surviving on their wits. And yet here they are in the same salon listening to a soprano sing and learning to play chess and getting to know each other. I just thought, wow, this is kind of interesting that these two groups that are so very different in appearance and background, they do find this common ground just by spending this time together, being forced to. That's my main takeaway.
So I've never read Ann Patchett before. I found it a little difficult to get started with it because something about her writing just kind of threw me a bit, but I eventually warmed up to it. But I found the book a little weird. The writing, it's got a dreamy sense about it. Ann Patchett will describe something in extreme detail. Like, it's almost as if you're floating around and the character does something, says something, and then it goes into this backstory and you're kind of floating through their backstory and everything is kind of drawn out that way. So the pacing is weird because it's a hostage taking. It's a fast action filled thing with a lot of tension and stuff, but you don't feel that tension so much because you are going through in slow motion and experiencing all this background stuff while this other stuff is happening. She does a thing which I don't typically like of writers, where she jumps from character to character. At least she doesn't do it in the same paragraph like Danielle Steele has been known to do, but she'll go be in one character's head for several paragraphs or several pages and then jump directly into another character's head and jump into another character's head. And that just seems to me to be kind of this dreamy floating sense of the book, which I found a little disorienting in some ways. But then I just accepted that that's what it was. It made me feel kind of like, even though there wasn't any magic in it, it was like some magical realism type books that I've read. Thinking about, was it Neil Gaiman, the Ocean at the End of the Drive?
Yeah,
it had that kind of sense to it, a sense of unreality, which was further emphasized by the fact that it was a hostage taking that drags on for months, and the characters are listening to opera and playing chess and all this other stuff. I read a little bit of an interview that was at the end of the book where she said that she was trying to essentially do a melodrama and to kind of structure the book like an opera. So that sense of unreality, I guess, was intentional on her part. And that's definitely how it felt to me. And it was very interesting. Like you say, it's a bit of a social experiment as an idea. And it vaguely reminded me of, I have a friend who for many years lived up in Yellowknife. He was working as a flight services specialist. And I went up to visit him. And the thing about Yellowknife as a city is that a lot of the people who live and work there are only there for the work. They live there for 10, 15, 20 years, and then they move back to where they came from. So when I went up there to visit, I was mixing with a group of people who I normally wouldn't have mixed with because I don't normally fly in their social circles. But because everyone there, or many of the people there, are kind of thrown into the city to work for a period of time, you cross the usual divisions and you just encounter different people than you might in a different place, like than I ever did here in Winnipeg. So it just reminded me a little bit of that, except amplified by several months and, you know. So in the end, I found it very interesting, enjoyed it, have little quibbles with it here and there, you know, but it was not quite what I was expecting. So now you get to...
Now I get to speak. I like what you said about the dreaminess of it. I get that, and I like that about it. This didn't quite stand up to my memory of it. You know, I think often when you have a memory of a book being so good, when you read it again, it can't possibly live up to that. I still loved it. What I really love about Ann Patchett is she can write pathos and humor at the same time and make them both very affecting, which I think is a rare quality. I think she has such keen insights. She'll be writing about a character and then she'll just come out with a sentence about something. And it's so brilliant that I need to put a sticky in my book. And she just, like, she gives a lot of attention and love to her characters, and I love that. And then, of course, I am a sucker for, like, the slightly over-the-top romanticism in this book. Like, anything that makes me want to clutch my chest, I love. So, yeah, Ann Patchett forever.
Yeah, one of those quotes that I enjoyed in the book was, it makes you wonder, all the brilliant things we might have done with our lives if only we suspected we knew how.
Yeah, so good.
Yeah.
It's so good.
It's also like I was thinking, like, the one of the things that was annoying me initially was that everything was so this and so that. Like, everyone was completely mesmerized by the singing. And it's like, okay, like, everybody? Like, literally everyone in the room is completely bedazzled by an opera singer. It's like, you know, and then everyone was struck by this, the beauty, and everyone was struck by this, and everyone was struck by that. And it makes sense when you recognize she's making it melodramatic intentionally and giving it that air of unrealism to make it kind of dreamy, you know. But initially that really annoyed me.
That everyone would just be united in this, that everyone would be somehow into opera.
Yeah, suddenly everyone's an opera fan. It's like, you know.
But I mean, what? There's nothing else, you know?
Yeah, no, I know. But yeah. No one else sings at all? Aside from the terrorist kid who no one believes can sing until it turns out he has the most incredible voice ever. That was, you know, a little over the top. But, I mean, over the top can be okay.
Yeah, like we say over the top, and you're right. I think I got the feeling that it was intentional. Like the final, you know, spoiler scene where the government storms, the army storms the house. And I just, when I was reading it, I just imagined the whole thing like in super slow motion, like, no,
totally.
Running across, you know, trying to Carmen and or whatever. And I think that's, but early on in the book, this isn't a spoiler, I think she actually just even says straight out, none of the terrorists get out alive.
Yeah,
like she says that. And then it was like she plants that seed and then doesn't come back to it, but it's there. She states it as plain as anything. So you kind of, you know, okay, this is going to end badly for half the people or whatever. Like,
well, and she referred to it a few times, usually through Mesner, who several times says, it always turns out the same way.
Yeah.
The government never capitulates. It always ends badly for the terrorists. Yeah. And he said it several times. And towards the end, he was getting increasingly stressed about it and clear that this isn't going to go well. So you knew.
Yeah. Like his last visit, he was just breaking up. He's like, I know what's going to happen. We have, you have to, you know, turn yourselves in. Like he
knew about the tunnel.
Up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, brings me to, I had kind of wondered if this didn't remind me of something. And in the interview that I read, they specifically mentioned that, oh yeah, this was based on the Peru
situation. You didn't read my blog post.
I did not. Okay. So everyone who's listening may know this already if you've read Toby's blog post. Yeah, but there was a kidnapping at the Japanese embassy or something related to the Japanese embassy in Peru that lasted months, and they did dig a tunnel. And
there were, like, the hostages were, like they were ordering pizza and, like, asking for soccer balls. Or not the hostages, the terrorists. Like, there were just some, like, kind of funny things that they were requesting.
Yeah. I only read the Wikipedia article, and it didn't mention anything about anybody falling in love and getting married and stuff like that. So I'm assuming that that's all creative interpretation. But, like, you hear about, what's it called, Stockholm Syndrome. And this makes that a little more understandable, I guess.
Well, no one is a bad guy in this book. Like, I think in her bio, talking about, you know, her writing sort of happy fiction, like this isn't a happy story, but all the people in it are really good. You know, even the terrorists, you know, they're not bad people.
No, they have legitimate grievances.
Yeah. And
they've all suffered.
They're not shooting people at random. They're treating people very nicely. And you do sympathize with them.
What's weird, too, is that when the bits of backstory they give about the terrorists, like people they've lost and things that have happened to them, the vice president is part of this government that did all this stuff to these people. But he's also such an interesting, likable character. I mean, there's the vice president who's like, no, I'm going to have to clean the floor here. I'm going to go around and pick up the garbage and I should weed these plants.
He was one of my favorite characters.
Because he really leans into that domesticity.
Yeah. And then when they finally are allowed to go outside, the first thing he does is make a beeline to the garden and start weeding and stuff and trying to make it look nice. Like, you know, and then I loved how she kind of wrote things from his perspective, where obviously, you know, he loves his wife and his children, but he's got something for the housekeeper too.
Yeah.
Well, when she sews up his cheek so tenderly.
Yeah. But I mean, okay, you know, so he's got something, but then he also like formed such a bond with, is it Ishmael? Another theme that came up is like, just by virtue of dumb luck, where some people get born into one type of situation versus into another, like in another life, he could have adopted him and had him as part of his family as much as his own family. And there are some really beautiful, tender scenes there, especially when they're out in the garden talking with, Ruben Iglesias and Mendoza, I think, the industrialist. The two of them were planning the future for Ishmael.
One wants to give him a job, the other wants to adopt him as his son. And you're reading it and you know that it's not going to happen, and they should know it's not going to happen.
But because Anne Patchett has told us several times it's not going to happen.
Maybe it will. Maybe she's lying.
I know.
The real ending of the book is where everyone went and lived on an island together forever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Sometimes you really want that ending.
Well, and you know, and what made it extra poignant is that we knew it was going to end, just like we know anything good is going to end. But that doesn't preclude the fact of doing it. You know, like they had those few weeks together. And
months.
Yeah, it was
months. Four months.
Four and a half months. Yeah.
Even though it was inevitable, it was going to end badly. Just like, you know, it, to me, it was like an analogy to life. Like, okay, things are going to eventually end, right? Like, I was talking about, if you want, every story has a sad ending if you follow it long enough. In this case, it's like, but they still did it. They fell in love and characters. Although of the two couples, I found the Gen and Carmen more relatable, I think, than Hasakawa and Roxanne. But I don't know how you guys felt. I just felt like
I found the Gen and Carmen relationship, that didn't make a lot of sense to me. Like, it seemed to come out of nowhere. Carmen is often described as a girl, and so I'm curious exactly how old she is.
I think they mentioned at one point 17.
Okay, see,
which is a little on edge.
Yeah, like, well,
how old is Gen? He's like in his 20s, right?
I thought late 20s or early 30s was what I remembered.
Okay. Like with Mr. Hosokawa and Roxanne's relationship, you saw how that built, you know, you saw where it started and how it slowly led up to what it became. But Carmen and Gen just came out of nowhere to me. And
the reason it came out of nowhere is because they were both masters of disguise. Like Carmen kept trying to blend into the woodwork. And again, as the translator, like he prided himself on being invisible. So when the fact that they, stuff started happening, I was like, look at all the stuff that was going on behind our backs. It's sort of how I thought of it.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought of that aspect because, I mean, Carmen is described as like being able to slip through the room with nobody noticing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Gen took great pride in being neutral in his translation to the point where sometimes it's not like he wasn't even mostly conscious of what he was saying.
Right. Like there's a description of him almost like a cashier passing money across the table, not even paying attention to the denominations when he was translating. I thought it was a really interesting image that he was doing it almost unconsciously.
Yeah. There was a lot of characterization in this book. There's not that much plot, really. Like, there's things that happen, but it's entirely character-driven. And a lot of time is spent talking about the characters' experiences. It does a very good job of showing, not telling, in terms of explaining the stories of different people's experiences and how that shapes the character. I thought that was really well done.
Yeah, it's really an ensemble cast. So, like, considering how many characters there are, they're really fully realized and rich characters. And and I find something that's amazing about this book is often when there's a lot of characters, it's hard to keep them straight and who's who. But with this, I never had that issue. And I mean, I think part of it is like, here's the Russians and, you'd see a Russian name and that's the Russians and here's the French. But she also just does a really good job of reminding you, like anytime Benjamin was mentioned, they talked about the shingles. And so that was a good cue to that's who that is. And I just think she did a phenomenal job of making all of these characters very distinct.
Yeah, that's a good point. It can be really hard to keep track of that many characters, but yeah, it was not an issue here.
Mm-hmm. Who was your favorite character?
That's really hard to tell. I don't know if I can pick one. I kind of felt sorriest for the generals as a group, probably especially for the guy with the shingles, because it's like, here he is trying to do all this stuff. They had all these planning. They planned for months and they did it, right? They had their attack and they got in perfectly. They got everything. They could have easily walked out with the president, except he had to go watch his soap operas. And they're like, what do we do? And then they make the dumbest decision possible of stay there, which, they recognize like months later. But the whole time before that, they're trying to figure out, how do we salvage this? And it's just like, oh, and there he is the whole time. His shingles are getting worse. Is going to get into his eye. Like, and they're still trying to be tough, but that they're not really going to shoot anybody, even though, I mean, they've trained for it. But like in the end, they don't really want to.
They kind of pride themselves that we're gentlemen, or that we aren't killers like those other terrorist groups.
Yeah, we're the nicer terrorist group, not those other guys who would have killed a person every day to make a point. So you feel bad for, and also like it reminded him of when he was a school teacher. And so there's this humanization. It's like he's a terrorist because terrible things happened to him and the people he knew, and he had to give up his job as a teacher to go fight to change something in the government. And so, yeah, I ended up feeling a lot of sympathy for the generals. Not that I think people should go and kidnap a room full of people, ultimately.
But if you're going to.
Yeah, be nice about it. And did you have a favorite?
I did like the vice president. But also, I really like the Gen Carmen relationship. I found that, although I was worried that while things were getting hot and heavy in that China cabinet, that the China was going to fall off the shelf and they'd be found out. Hmm. But
that was a risk they were willing to take.
Yes.
Yeah.
How about you, Toby? Do you either have a favorite character, or what do you think? Who was the main character? You mentioned this was an ensemble.
Yeah. I mean, I think, if, we're thinking of this as an opera and there's sort of a leading lady and a leading man, then, Roxanne is obviously the leading lady. And I think Mr. Hosokawa would be the leading man.
You think?
Yeah. Who would you pick as the leading man? Oh, really?
Because he was central to everything. Everything went through him.
Yeah. He was very, very important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in the end, should we spoil that?
I want to talk about the epilogue, so yeah, let's spoil it.
Yeah, so in the end, Mr. Hosokawa dies trying to stop them from shooting Carmen. Mm-hmm. And then Gen and Roxanne get married.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Isn't that threw me for a
that's
loop.
Like, I really disliked that. Like, I get why they got together. I think, you know, it's about keeping the memory of these people alive. But they didn't have to. I mean, they...
People in coming after trauma might do things that are, you know, not logical in certain ways. Like, trauma can...
But, like, we never saw, or we probably did, but it doesn't, like, Gen and Roxanne... Like, their relationship was one where Gen would just be a translator. Like, they weren't friends. They weren't, I mean, they were in this situation together. So, you know, that bonded them in a level. But I really disliked that epilogue.
Yeah, it didn't resonate with me. It just seemed like such a weird, random pairing. I couldn't really understand what either of them were getting out of it. Although I suppose like Roxanne again could kind of talk like Mr. Asakawa. She has that, but I mean, you know, there wasn't anything about Roxanne that was like Carmen. I thought like there wasn't, what were they getting out of it? Gen kind of seemed a little like out of it. Remember they went for that walk to try to find a restaurant or whatever after they got married, and Simon, the French ambassador.
Yeah.
Like, he just seemed like he was...
Like, wasn't he afraid? There was like an open space and he was like afraid of it or something.
Yeah. He was kind of in a daze and I was not a fan of that epilogue. Yeah.
Well, and Simon had mentioned that maybe it had been a little early to get married. So it sounds like it wasn't really that long after everything had happened. Which makes me think this was a trauma response to, you know, this wild, tumultuous thing that happened to all of them. But it is weird because it's like, yeah, so my boss, who I really liked and respected and stuff, and you're the one that he was in love with, so now I'm in love with you?
Yeah, it makes no sense.
Yeah, it was...
I mean, I guess everyone in that house was in love with Roxanne.
Well, according to the author, yeah, absolutely.
That was part of the magic realism.
Literally everyone.
But I think it's because she, you know, she represents this ideal life, and she really just, like, projects back what people want. But Jen did seem a bit immune to that in the way that a lot of others were, and maybe that's because he was falling in love with Carmen. But I mean, as an author, you make choices, and that epilogue could have just been them having a coffee later and talking about it. Like, why did they get married?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a weird choice.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder if it would last or if it would fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the movie Speed, they made that.
Love that movie.
Yeah. Well, one of the characters, I forget if it was Sandra Bullock's character or Keanu Reeves' character, said that a relationship forged in tumultuous times often don't last. And then,
like that you're quoting Speed.
Yeah, well, and in Speed 2, Sandra Bullock's character had an entirely different boyfriend because it didn't
last.
Well,
I didn't watch that one because Keanu Reeves wasn't in it, so.
Yeah. Oh,
but they were on a boat in the second one, weren't they?
Yeah.
It was a boat out of control instead of a bus.
Yeah, it was cheesy fun. Yeah.
But no Keanu Reeves.
No
so Keanu,
no.
Forget it. Did either of you watch the trailer for this movie?
I did not.
I did.
Okay. First of all, it makes this situation seem extremely serious, where I feel like there's a lot of levity and lightness in this book. And then also everyone spoke English, which I feel away so much of the subtleties of everything. And like, I don't know where Jen fits in then. And
yeah, I didn't pick up on everyone speaking English. But the thing that struck me with the trailer that didn't ring true is that somebody gets shot in the chest.
Yes, I think it was the accompaniment.
So instead of him like dying from not getting his insulin, they just flat out shoot him.
Yeah.
By accident.
Well, it looks like he's like running back into the house and
one
gets
of the
shot.
Young terrorists like gun. He's, you know, he shoots by accident. And I'm like, wait a second, what? Like, yeah. So I don't know if that must be a change in the movie. And I was thinking, yeah, you're right. It may look like a super intense hostage situation, almost like an action movie.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking after I saw the trailer that you could probably do interpretations of this novel many different ways. You could film it as a comedy. You could.
I think it's been turned into an actual opera.
Okay, yeah. Makes sense. Yeah. Like you could, you know, with all the people going in and out of the doors and stuff, it could be like a farce. You could do it like a horror movie. Like remember how most of it there was like that misty gloom around the outside. Yeah. I was thinking Stephen King's The Mist. Like I was thinking like you could this, just like how Roxanne was a mirror to everybody. This story, depending on whatever spin you could put on it, it would have very different results. It seems like the movie, although I haven't seen the whole movie, but I did see the trailer, it did not give me the feeling that the novel gave me at all.
Yeah.
Well, a movie is an entirely separate work, even if it's heavily inspired by a book. It's a different medium, and it can't be the same. So I guess this is a fine example of that.
I think Julianne Moore was a good casting choice, though.
Mm. Yeah, she plays Roxanne.
Yeah. Mm.
I don't know if I would want to watch a movie version of this.
No, it would ruin the book for me, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so next time to read Watch Party. She did lean a bit into stereotypes about the different nationalities, though. You know?
Yeah.
French guy? Of course he cooks.
Russians? Drinkers.
Yeah.
And long-winded storytellers. Oh, my goodness. Well, every time the Russians started talking, it's like, will you just get to the point, buddy?
Well, they weren't very heavily featured in this book. Yeah. So when they were there, you know, they had a lot to say.
But, you know, to be fair, like in opera, a lot of the characters are extreme stereotypes. Like if you watch it, you'd be like, oh, okay, well, this wouldn't pass the test today. Like, you know, and like they were kind of like avatars of certain things that she wanted to kind of talk about. But and I was just thinking now, thinking back to the novel with maybe a different insight, because remember there's the Russian guy, he was falling in love with Roxanne, like every other person in the house, but he wanted to tell her. He kept trying to get Gen, but that wasn't the right time. Or, you know, Gen's got his own business with Carmen going on, and he kept trying to avoid the Russian guy. But I'm thinking, like, did he avoid the Russian guy because he was starting to have feelings for Roxanne? Or was he just avoiding the Russian guy because the Russian guy told really long stories?
Yeah, the Russian guy seemed annoying.
He did seem annoying, but I'm just wondering, because we're trying to figure out how does Gen and Roxanne end up at the end? Could we have, reading between the lines there maybe a bit too much?
Well, the character was thinking to himself, he didn't really want to say the words, I love you, to Roxanne as an avatar for someone else, like to say it's someone else's words. He felt uncomfortable with that.
Also, his boss is,
I will see to his boss. He's like, my boss is into her. I can't get this Russian guy come in and muscle in.
I will say one thing I did like about that interaction is that he wanted to tell her he loved her, but that's all he expected was to say, I love you, and I just want you to know I love you. And he didn't want anything else in return. He didn't expect anything from her. He wasn't like expecting her to fall in love with him or even acknowledge it particularly. He just wanted to tell her. And like it was okay to just tell someone you love them without expecting anything back and without, you know, being weird about it. And I liked that. You know, after he, like I was cringing going up to it because it's like, dude, really? Like you're gonna
profess book about the paintings?
Yeah, the art book that got smuggled in from. I was like, oh my god.
Yeah, but still, he was gonna like confess his love, and I thought it would be like, you know, on his knees and something like that. And of course, she'd have to try to avoid offending him so that something bad didn't happen. And you know, but no, he just wanted to say I love you and then leave it at that. And I thought, I can respect that idea. I wish it was easier to do that in general, or that it felt easier to do that. You just say to people, I love you, and then not expect anything from them. I thought that was actually beautiful. So he was an annoying character in some ways, and I didn't like the long-winded storytelling nature, but man, he made a good point there. And so the author made a really good point there like that. I like that a lot.
Well, and also, like, I think, like, as a reader, we shared Gen's discomfort through the whole scene, but it felt like Roxanne was used to this kind of adulation. Yeah. And so she was like, oh yeah, thanks. And you kind of think it reminded me a little bit. Have you guys ever seen the movie Moneyball? Baseball. And there's this one character who's talking to the owner, who's played by Brad Pitt. And he's a Christian. And he said, I just want you to know, I've been praying for you and your family. And Brad Pitt says, no problem. I just love that line. It acknowledges it. It doesn't, you know, it's just like, you just want him to know and moving on. So it's kind of like, I love you. No problem.
Yeah. So we've been talking about it for a while. Do we have any final points we want to make about the book before we move on to our next segment?
So I want to say that Spooky of Opera and the Manitoba Opera is doing Carmen this next month. Obviously, maybe no coincidence that one of the characters in this novel is also named Carmen. And I've been dropping hints to my family that I want tickets to it. So I don't know how successful that's been.
Are you an opera guy?
I've seen Carmen a couple times, but I wouldn't call myself like a big like opera guy. But I'd go.
I'm glad I got the opportunity to reread this book. I love Ann Patchett. Really, everyone should read everything she's ever written.
So we'll call that a hearty endorsement.
Yeah.
I will also say it was a very interesting read. I enjoyed it. It's not like the best book I ever read. I'm not as into it as Toby is, but it caught me off guard and had a lot of things I liked in it. Definitely worth a read. Okay, so then we should move on to our next segment called Can You Tell Me a Book I Would Also Like? Who's got a book that someone else would also like?
I have a book. So my book is A Gentleman in Moscow by my boyfriend, Amor Tolles.
Does he know?
Not yet. He does not know yet. Like Ann Patchett, Amor Tolles is one of my favorite authors, though I have only read two of his books. Though to be fair, he has only published three. And him and Ann Patchett are actually friends. There are YouTube videos of them talking to each other about their respective books, which are a delight, especially for a super fan like me. So A Gentleman in Moscow is historical fiction. It's about Count Alexander Rostov, who is deemed unrepentant by a Bolshevik tribunal in 1922 and is sentenced to house arrest in a hotel across the street from the Kremlin, where he lives for the rest of his life. So just like Bel Canto, the whole novel takes place in one location, though instead of, you know, only a few months, it's decades of this guy's life. Like Bel Canto, it's witty, it's moving. Tolles he's a remarkable writer with just such a keen, sharp insight into his characters. It's a big book, but it is well worth every single page. And a TV show just got released of the book with Ewan McGregor as the lead, who I don't know how I feel about Ewan McGregor playing a Russian count, but I will reserve my judgment until I actually see it. So that's A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Tolles.
When I was reading Bel Canto, I was trying to think of another book that sort of threw a bunch of people together in a room, and I was trying to see something that was more than just a bunch of people in a room, and oddly enough, I kept coming back to George Orwell's Animal Farm. So that is the book that I am recommending, but not just the book. And for those that aren't familiar with Animal Farm, it's kind of a fairy tale story about a farm in England where the animals realize that they are being exploited. So they have a revolution and they get rid of the farmer, only to find that the system of government they put into place themselves eventually corrupts and the pigs take over. And at the end of the novel, the pigs and the humans, the other animals can't tell the difference between the pigs and the humans. And so it was sort of George Orwell's take on the Russian Revolution. And it's, you know, required reading in a lot of schools, so I'm sure many of our listeners have already read it, but it was kind of interesting to revisit it. But I didn't revisit it as the novel. I revisited it as a graphic novel, particularly one that I'm holding here, that was adapted by an an artist who I think his name is pronounced Odyr. It's O-D-Y-R. It's a one-name person. And if you have children and you want to freak them out, I would recommend taking this home and reading it like a story time book, because it reads very much like a picture book, but it will, you know, give them nightmares. And so I really enjoyed that. And it's also, this version is authorized by the Orwell Estate, which hasn't always been the case with adaptations for Animal Farm. So, for example, there was a movie version from 1954, and the only way it got made was George Orwell at this point had died. So his widow was convinced to give the rights away in return for her meeting her favorite actor, Clark Gable. So she met Clark Gable, who was not involved in the movie at all. And so she signed the rights away. But guess what? She signed them away to the CIA, who secretly bought the rights, and the movie was secretly funded by them, and it was used as propaganda against socialism during the Cold War. And they even changed the ending to make it suit their purposes, which is crazy. And then there was a 1999 version, which was done by the Hallmark Channel. It was also not exactly faithful to the source material. It sort of was made in 1999, like I said, and it reflects the fall of the Soviet Union in an epilogue where there's a hip young human farmer takes over the farm again and promises to learn from the mistakes of the past. And most interestingly, there's a new version in production, directed and produced by Andy Serkis, who many will know is the guy that wears all the motion capture stuff from all like Lord of the Rings. And so I don't
know. Gollum.
Yes. So I don't know. Will this one involve hobbits? We won't. We'll be out next year. So we'll see. So that's my recommendation, Animal Farm, George Orwell.
You heard that right. Trevor recommends you traumatize your children with it. With Animal Farm. I took the steps of finding a read-alike on a list of recommended read-alikes, and I picked one that I have not read myself, but I am interested in reading the author because she's kind of been on my to-read list for a while. So my recommendation is The Lacuna by Barbara Kingsolver. And we'll just read a description of the book. Born in the United States, reared in a series of provisional households in Mexico, Harrison Shepard is mostly a liability to his social-climbing flapper mother, Salome. From a coastal island jungle to the unpaved neighborhoods of 1930s Mexico City, through a disastrous stint at a military school in Virginia and back again, his fortunes never steady as Salome finds her rich men friends always on the losing side of the Mexican Revolution. Sometimes she gives her son cigarettes instead of supper. He aims for invisibility, observing his world and recording everything with a peculiar, selfless irony in his notebooks. Life is whatever he learns from servants putting him to work in kitchens, errands he runs in the streets, and one fateful day, by mixing plaster for famed Mexican muralist Diego Rivera, making himself useful in the household of Rivera, his wife Frida Kahlo, and exiled Bolshevik leader Lev Trotsky. Young Shepard inadvertently casts his lot with art and revolution and the howling gossip and reportage that dictate public opinion. A violent upheaval sends him north to a nation newly caught up in the internationalist goodwill of World War II. In the mountain city of Asheville, North Carolina, he remakes himself in America's hopeful image. Under the watch of his peerless stenographer, Violet Brown, he finds an extraordinary use for his talents of observation. But political winds continue to throw him between North and South in a plot that turns many times on the unspeakable breach, the lacuna, between truth and public presumption. It's a gripping story of identity, connection with our past, and the power of words to create or devastate, unfolding at a moment when the entire world seems bent on reinventing itself at any cost. So it sounds like it would be a good follow-up to Bel Canto, or at least interesting, and I hope to read it someday. So now we'll move on to Nerd Words for Word Nerds, in which we nerd out about word out. That doesn't make sense. Anyway, go ahead.
Sure. So, I mean, my word was new to me this month. It may be a word that you've heard of, but it is mortadella. Now, I came across this word because I was on one of those websites that are kind of like clickbait, where it's talking about celebrities and their favorite sandwiches. So I thought, yeah, I'll click on that. And so I came across Anthony Bourdain, rest in power. His favorite sandwich was made with mortadella. And he discovered it when he was in an unnamed Latin American country. So I thought, well, there's the connection to Bel Canto.
Why was it unnamed?
Well, I mean, because it was like a very, like, I'm sure the website was written by like AI or something. Like, it didn't say unnamed, but it just said South America or whatever. So I'm just adding that part to try to connect my nerd word a little more closely to the book.
So it was in the host country.
That godforsaken country.
So getting back to what mortadella is, it's pretty much just like fancy bologna.
Okay.
I'm
surprised you didn't know what this was already.
I never knew. I thought
I didn't know.
So it's like imagine bologna, but like a wider girth, a larger
and thinner.
Yeah. And it has little bits of pure fat in it, like little kind of squares of fat. And some versions of it have pistachios in there. But purists say no to the pistachios. So I thought the sandwich sounds pretty good. So I thought I was going to make it. And I thought, where am I going to find mortadella?
DeLuca's.
Can find it everywhere.
Yeah.
I thought I'd have to go to some kind of fancy like butcher. No. Yeah. Your local, not to buzz market anything, your local Freshco, your local No Frills will have mortadella. And this is what you do. You take it, and if you can imagine, you get a nice big cast iron frying pan, get some olive oil going in there, and then you take the mortadella, and you're supposed to fold it kind of like an accordion, if you can imagine this, until you have kind of a stack maybe about, 3 inches high. You do that three times in this pan. And then on the top of each stack, you put a piece of cheese. Now, the recipe says provolone. which worked okay. It didn't melt as well. I think any kind of melty cheese, maybe mozzarella might be better. But provolone, I wanted to do it exactly as Anthony Bourdain had it. And then you cook it just for about a minute until it gets kind of crispy on the bottom. Oh, wait, no, this is what you do. So you don't add the cheese yet. You flip it. And then once you flipped it, you put the cheese on top of the part that you flipped. So you have three stacks now that are crispy on the bottom, crispy on the top with cheese. And then what you do is you take a Kaiser bun and you put it face down in the pan, the hot oil. And the Kaiser sucks up all of the fat and the juices. And then you take a spatula and you take all three of these little stacks and you put them in one giant stack. So you have a giant stack of mortadello, and then you take the bun off that's kind of like toasted and browned. And on one side you put Dijon mustard, the other side you put mayonnaise. You stick all the meat in there, and you just eat it. And I'll tell you what, it's pretty delicious.
Can you fit it in your mouth? This thing sounds like it would be nearly a foot tall.
Well, it kind of squishes down. And also, I didn't realize how much mortadella I would actually need to make an Anthony Bourdain style one. So mine was a lot thinner than what the thing, because it is quite thin meat. So I was kind of impressed how delicious it was. I've only made the ones. It was easy, delicious. So mortadella.
I always wanted to have a pimento sandwich ever since I heard about them.
I don't know how that would work because pimentos are very... Well, I mean, I just think of pimentos in olives and they're like really little.
I think there's like a pimento loaf you can get, right? Which is kind of like bologna with pimentos in there. Or is that olive loaf?
No, well, pimento, what I'm thinking of is there's a spread. There's a spread that's made with it. It's American southern part of the U.S. type thing.
Oh.
It's like a junk food. You can get it in gas stations.
It's not there. Pimento cheese?
Yeah.
It is pimento cheese?
Yeah, it's mostly a cheese.
Oh, okay.
Which maybe with my lactose intolerance wouldn't actually be that great, but,
pimento,
you know.
Pimento cheese. So kind of like a Velveeta consistency?
Something like that, yeah. It's often described as junk food, so, you know. Hmm. Anyway, hopefully I remember the name correctly.
I'm going in a completely different direction from mortadella, although it starts with an M. My word is mellifluous. Which is one of those words that's just nice to say, but it also is relevant for this book because it's a word that pertains to sound. It means sweet or musical, pleasant to hear, as in Dennis's voice is mellifluous. And it comes from two Latin roots, the noun mel, meaning honey. That's also where we get the French miel, and the verb fluor, meaning to flow. So when you say something is mellifluous, you're saying it flows like honey, which is very lovely. And I guess in addition to describing sound, it can also be used to describe the taste of something, like something that has a sweetness to it, like wine, though I have never heard it used in anything to describe anything other than sound. So
definitely not for a sandwich.
No, I do not think
a mortadella sandwich would be mellifluous. Singing could be.
Yes,
that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My word I discovered on social media and it just spoke to me. It is herkle-derkle. Which, have you seen that online?
I have, yeah.
No, I haven't.
Haven't? Okay. So it is of Scots origin, and it means to lie in bed or lounge about when one should be up and about. And that, to me, sounds lovely. Apparently, it has become popular as of late. Apparently, the younger generation sometimes refers to rotting in bed when you just lay around in bed all day. But herkle-derkling is just much more fun.
Like doing it when you don't have a mental illness. Like if you're depressed and lying in bed, that sounds more like bed rotting. But herkle-derkle sounds like delightful. Like, you know, maybe pulling the covers up, having a book, a coffee.
Well, it doesn't specify.
It doesn't
right?
say that
It just
part.
Says to lie in bed or lounge about when you should be up and about. So it could be because you're depressed or it could be because it's just nice to lie in bed.
Mm-hmm. Herkle-derkle does not sound like something you do when you're depressed.
That is true.
Yeah.
It is a cheerful word. Mm-hmm. And the link that we'll have in the show notes is from a site discussing how it's an actual word from, like, 1700s or something like that in Scotland. So it's not a made-up thing, unless they just made it up and we all bought it.
Sounds a little bit like a cousin to the hygge, a Scandinavian word, right? Which is like lounging about wearing cozy, like, slippers and talking softly and drinking tea and reading books and whatnot.
Yeah, it's more of an atmosphere, that word, isn't it?
I don't know. But I wonder if you could herkle-derkle and then hygge.
I
feel like
hope so.
Herkle-derkling would be part of hygge, maybe?
Hmm.
Or it could be.
Dear reader, if you have an opinion on Hygge versus Herkel Durkel and how they fit together, please let us know. WPL-podcast@winnipeg.ca.
Hopefully WP.podcast.
No, that's the email address. Oh, no, that stays the same. That stays the same. I hope to do a lot of Herkel Durkling soon.
I'd like to welcome everyone to episode one of our podcast on our new host.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this month, so thank you for joining us, dear readers. For our next month, we're going to read and discuss The Apollo Murders by Chris Hadfield. 1973, a final top-secret mission to the moon. Three astronauts in a tiny spaceship a quarter million miles from home, a quarter million miles from help. NASA is about to launch Apollo 18. While the mission has been billed as a scientific one, flight controller Kazimierz Kaz Zemeckis knows there is a darker objective. Intelligence has discovered a secret Soviet space station spying on America, and Apollo 18 may be the only chance to stop it. But even as Kaz races to keep the NASA crew one step ahead of the Russian rivals, a deadly accident reveals that not everyone involved is quite who they were thought to be. With political stakes stretched to the breaking point, the White House and the Kremlin can only watch as their astronauts collide on the lunar surface, far beyond the reach of law or rescue. Have comments or book suggestions for us? Send us an email. Our email address is wpl-podcast@winnipeg.ca. If you go to our website, wpl-podcast.winnipeg.ca, you can also find all our past episodes. If you haven't already, subscribe to Time to Read on your favorite podcasting service, maybe leave us a review, and tell your book-loving friends about us too. And until next time, make sure you find
Time to Read.
Armor Tolls, I'll tell you that much.
No.
For sure
not.
What
kind of name is Armor?
Amor.
Amor! What kind of name is Amor?
I have no idea. Mm. Yeah.
What kind of nationality is that?
Well, he's American.
Bah. But, what kind of nationality is his grandparents?
I'll ask him when we...
when next time you have an online...
When you let him know that you love him.
Yes.
And just gonna leave it there like that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. He is happily married, as am I, but, you know.
Well, yeah, but that's why you can do the Russian thing. Yeah.
And you can express your love with no
right,
kind
that's
of...
Right, that's true.
No strings attached. Just want to let you know I love you. Literally love you. Mm-hmm. Bye.
Although, to be fair, I also love Ann Patchett. Although, I don't know if, like, I want her to be my mom or, like, my sister or, like, my girlfriends.
Right.
Like,
you want her in your life somehow, but what the role is unclear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Employer, you could be, like, the
maid. You know, she has that bookstore, and she has often said that running the bookstore, it's like she has a whole bunch of daughters who love reading, and they talk about books all the time, and I'm like, oh.
There's your in.
Yeah.
I bet she'd be a good boss.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you need character references, we got you.